Thank you. Be seated.
The court is ready to hear argument from Relator, Granada Corporation versus First Court of Appeal.
May it please the court, Mr. Grant Cook present argument for Relator. He has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'm Grant Cook. I represent what we call the Granada defendants in this case, a group of corporate defendants as well as a group of individuals. The lawsuit arises out of two somewhat complex business transactions which spawned four different lawsuits which have been consolidated, raising a variety of causes of action of including fraud. What brings us here today is that the Court of Appeals upon the application of the what I'll just call the plaintiffs has issued its writ of mandamus conditionally to the second of two district judges who made the same rulings in favor of the Granada defendants on their applications for protection from discovery concerning a series of documents. There are really two issues presented, or two questions. One has to do with what we contend was an inadvertent disclosure of four documents out of 18,000. And the second has to do with whether or not the crime fraud exception to the attorney-client privilege rule has application and therefore causes another series of documents to be discoverable. The Court of Appeals held that they were in both instances. The issues before the court today, as I appreciate this court's posture in a case such as this, where the mandamus has come up from the Court of Appeals, is really whether or not the decisions of the two trial courts exceeded their discretion. And if they did, whether or not the decisions of the two trial courts left the plaintiffs without an adequate remedy by appeal. Now, the standard of review in this matter, most recently expressed, I think, in this Chrysler case that came out last week from the court, that made it clear, I believe, if it wasn't already, that the standard review was an abuse of discretion review. Now, it's been stated a number of ways. In the Johnson versus Fourth Court case, the court stated it this way, that even if the Court of Appeals exercised better judgment than the trial court, we must uphold the trial court if its order, quote, has some basis in reason and law. Now, it's my understanding that the trial court's discretion can be abused in two ways. One is factually, one and the other is legally. And the court spoke to that in the Walker opinion last February. On the factual side, the court has stated that an abuse of discretion by the trial court can only occur where the court could have reached only one conclusion or one decision relative to the facts, but reached another. In some of the other cases, it's been characterized in the language that the court's findings or rulings relative to the fact were arbitrary and unreasonable. A legal abuse of discretion, the Walker opinion tells us, occurs when the trial court has clearly failed to analyze and apply the law correctly. Both of those statements are made by the court at page 840 of the Walker opinion. So I'm going to try to analyze what the trial court did given that those rules of the road, as I appreciate them from the court's prior opinions. First, did the trial court, let's just talk about legal abuse of discretion or abuse of discretion on the question of law. On the inadvertent disclosure side of the case, the trial court, two of them, understand that there was first a decision from the 165th District Court, which included findings of facts specifically on both of these issues, both inadvertent disclosure and crime fraud. Subsequently, the case was transferred out of that judge's court and assigned to Judge Bianchi, I don't remember his court number. Plaintiffs came in and made a motion with Judge Bianchi that he set aside the prior order and adopt the recommendations that have been made by Special Master relative to which documents were discoverable and which ones were not. Judge Bianchi denied their motion and specifically refused to set aside the prior order or adopt the findings of the master. Now, what the trial courts have held, because both of them have held the same thing, on the inadvertent production issue is that the legal concept is that merely making delivery of a document is not in itself a voluntary waiver of the attorney-client privilege, assuming that the claim the document is covered by the attorney-client privilege. The courts held that if there are reasonable safeguards that have been put in place in connection with the processing, evaluating, and screening of the documents by the side that's producing them, and if the delivery of the document in question was indeed inadvertent, and if immediate steps were taken to rectify the inadvertent delivery within reasonable time, or I think it says as quickly as possible after the deliverer knew or should have known that he's let something out that he shouldn't have, and furthermore, if the number of documents involved is so great that those that are being processed and handed over for review, and the number that have been inadvertently disclosed or delivered is small relative to that, that those things can find, under those circumstances, that the mere handing over of the document, which occurred with respect to four documents out of 150,000 in this case, is not a waiver of the attorney-client privilege.
If we were to adopt that test, would this encourage people to make a larger production than necessary in order to increase their chances if there was an inadvertent disclosure of showing that they had an immense production and therefore it was difficult to find everything within?
I don't know about other lawyers, but it wouldn't have that result with me, because the larger production is more work on the part of we're talking about the defense side here, and that's usually what it is. And he would still, just because you've got a lot of documents, that in itself doesn't get there. You've got to show that there was a system put in place that was reasonable, that would have safeguarded this to the extent possible. Obviously, the larger number of documents, the more the chance is that something can get through the screen. But I don't think so, Your Honor, because I think that the flip side of it, the side of the issue that the Court of Appeals came down on, which is based in Texas anyway, only on one sentence, which is clearly dicta in the Gulf Oil case, is too harsh a remedy. That's the one that they contend for here, and that is that if I voluntarily hand you the document, you didn't take it out of my briefcase and somebody didn't find it in my wastebasket, and that's not involved in this case. That satisfies the voluntary language in the rule of evidence with respect to the waiver of the privilege. And we believe that in the trial courts both believe that the better rule of law was that espoused in a number of cases. There's a Texas case, Fuller versus Preston, that predates our facts by, I think it was a 1983 case out of Dallas. And there, that wasn't a mandamus, it was an appeal. And there was a letter, a doctor, I believe it was a letter, that was offered in evidence, and I believe it was the defendant, doesn't make a difference, the side who had produced the letter stood up and said, wait a minute, we didn't mean to give you that letter. We object to its entry into evidence. And the trial court overruled that objection, and it went into the record, and that was a point on appeal. They said it was an attorney-client, a document covered by the privilege, and they had not intended to give it over, since it was given over by mistake. The Court of Appeals said, well, there isn't any evidence. You didn't put on any evidence of mistake or inadvertence. And in the absence of evidence, we can't sustain that point of error. It went on to say about three sentences later, because they were sending it back for a new trial, in the next trial, this letter will be admissible unless there's evidence presented of accident or inadvertence or mistake.
Well, isn't the more direct answer, though, to Judge Phelps' question, that the standard that you're urging provides an incentive for people to deliver documents by the truckload instead of the boxload?
Well, sir, I don't think so. I can't speak for all the lawyers in the state. I'm a commercial trial lawyer. I'm a plaintiff some days and a defendant the other, so we don't have that dichotomy.
Well, you at least have
I don't think so, because it would be so much more onerous on the side that's trying to do a dumping number on the other side, and we've all seen that. But it would still be, he can't just say, well, I gave him a million documents, and ha-ha, there were 10 in there that were really frivolous. If that's all he says, he loses under the standard that the trial court applied, and that these other cases, mostly from the federal courts around the country.
Need to add in there that you had a clerk look at them.
That would be part of, that would be part of whether or not the system you established was reasonable.
But you'd have a much better chance of prevailing under that standard if you had a million documents than if you had 1,000 documents.
Well, sir, Judge Doggett, I just respectfully say, only if you, in fact, had a system and you utilize that system. So that would just increase the burden on the producing lawyer more so probably than the receiving lawyer.
Do you believe the privilege can ever be waived in a case that involves large-scale production if you have a system set up for a clerk to sift through the documents as the documents go?
Yes, sir, I do. If you have a system, but it's not followed, there's a fairly recent case that
Well, suppose you have an affidavit that says my clerk looked through all million documents and we sent them over there and we just missed a few of them. Won't that be enough so that you're pretty well covered?
Well, that's one leg of, I think, in some of these cases they lift as many as five pieces to such a system. That's one of them, but it's not all of them. Because you have to show some diligence on the part of the lawyer. You say, well, I had my secretary look at them and be sure that nothing had a lawyer's name on it. I don't think that would cut the mustard. I think a lawyer has to look at it, for one thing. So I think there are a number of different facets. And
lawyer did look at them. In fact, he looked at four documents, and he let them go.
He kept out the originals, or one set of copies of all four, Your Honor, and copies of four of them were elsewhere in the record. But that's true. The lawyer did look at them.
All right. Now, would we not encourage sloppiness if we were to adopt your rule? Take, for instance, a scenario where you are, in fact, as a strategy, you want to dump a trainload of documents because you know there's some smoking guns in there and you're kind of hoping that they won't find them. And you just say, error on the side of give them more. Give them just so much more that time up for a long time and hope they don't find the needle in the haystack. So you don't care whether or not you inadvertently give them something you're not supposed to, because by your theory or the test that you're asking us to adopt, there is no way.
Well, I'm not saying that just because there's a lot of documents and only a few are alleged later to have been inadvertently disclosed, that gets me on first base. That's a base hit. I am not contending for that, John. I'm saying that you have to have a system that's reasonable, and no system's perfect. Now, obviously, if a guy says, I've gave him a million documents and I had this great system, if the trial court believes that the lawyer was really diligent, then he should lose. The trial court in this case found that he was diligent, notwithstanding the fact that four documents got through the net. But just because it's a great number, no, we're not contending that at all.
Would you, I'm just asking this question to make sure you get plenty of time to argue, but would you move on to the crime fraud exception?
Yes, sir. And may I just, before that, touch on the, okay, I'll move on the crime fraud on the legal issue. We don't really have a dispute, as I read the briefs, as to what the law is, that if there's a claim by, in this case, the plaintiffs, that the documents are not protected because they're the result of the client seeking or obtaining advice for purpose of committing crime or fraud, and that the documents have a relationship to the crime or fraud, then they're not privileged documents. And there's no dispute in the briefs that that's what the law is. When the problem arises, and the courts are all in agreement, starting in the Supreme Court of the United States, and Judge Cardoza, I think, saying that mere pleadings don't get you there. You've got to make a prima facie case of crime or fraud.
I had some difficulty telling exactly what the Court of Appeals did in this case because of its use of all the numbers for the documents. Did they, as you read their opinion, clearly provide that these four memoranda came within the crime fraud?
Yes, sir. The four memoranda are within those
numbered
62 documents that are numbered. Now, they've also said in the previous paragraph, the documents delivered in August and September, and those are the four memorandum as well. But yes, sir, they did.
And what is the difference between the 104 documents that were tendered on November 28th and 88, and then the 115 on October the 13th?
All right, sir. The 104 documents were tendered in response to a request for production from the defendant that I represent, Granada. Okay. The 115 that were tendered a year later came as a result of an informal, there never was a request for production of documents then, an informal request while the deposition of the Fulbright-Jaworski lawyer was being taken. They said, will you produce the file? We responded by saying, we will review the file. We'll tell you, obviously, that's going to have some, we think, some privileged documents in it coming out of the law firm. And we will give you a list, and we'll give you the ones we don't claim privilege, and we'll go through the same steps that we, insofar as trying to agree. Those that we can't agree, we'll submit them in camera. So the 115 were the product of the submission of documents that were from Fulbright-Jaworski files. There had not previously been a request for production made. Never was a formal one. Now, there are some overlapping, because obviously a memo from Fulbright-Jaworski lawyer to Granada man would be in both those files.
Of the 104 documents that were produced, what percentage of those went to the plaintiffs?
You mean as a result of the Court of Appeals opinion?
Well, as a result of the Court of Appeals opinion.
I believe, Your Honor, that the Court of Appeals opinion directs that the plaintiffs can keep the four documents they've already got, and it lists 62 other documents. And the vast majority, and I can't tell you the exact number of those, came out of the Fulbright-Jaworski file. Some of them came out of the Granada file.
Had any of the 104 documents that were tendered back in 88 been supplied inadvertently to the plaintiffs?
No, the 104 is in addition to the four.
Okay.
I think that's right, Judge.
Which set do we have here in camera?
You have the 104, and you don't have the 115 because we backed off on some of those, and I believe there are 85, Bob, right? That are remaining out of the Fulbright-Jaworski production in camera. And interestingly enough, since you raised that, the application for mandamus in the Court of Appeals by the plaintiff said, tell Judge Bianchi to set aside his order and the prior district judge's order and adopt the finding of the master, which had come before that. And the master had split the baby. He said, okay, here, give him some documents and not some other. The Court of Appeals didn't do that. The Court of Appeals just started afresh and said they did. We were, based on our review of the documents, here's the ones that they get, and they keep the rest of them. And that was a different set. I believe there were 25 documents that the master had held, he said, could lead to the discovery of crime or fraud evidence, which the Court of Appeals said, no, those don't go to the plaintiffs. And there were 9 documents that the master had said were survived the privilege claim, and the Court of Appeals disagreed and included those in the bunch. They said, no, they're under the crime fraud exception.
Let me ask you this question, too. See if I can get at it. If the Court of Appeals ruling had been the trial court's ruling with regard to crime fraud, would you be complaining of it?
Big time.
Up here?
Yes, sir, so, because I would
so
fit.
Your argument is not merely that this ruling should be left at the discretion of the trial court, and it goes beyond that.
Well, sir, insofar as the trial court's findings of fact, where you have some disputed evidence, which we did on both sides of this
That's
equation,
right. If the Court of Appeals had been the trial court,
we say it's conclusive on Court of Appeals and conclusive on this court.
All right. So if the Court of Appeals had been the trial court and then made those findings, would those be conclusive on us?
On the
I mean,
facts.
Is your complaint of the Court of Appeals merely that they were the Court of Appeals acting like a trial court, or are you saying they erred as a matter of law in the decisions that they made,
the
as well as improperly in, intruding on the...
Yes, sir, I do. I say they erred as a matter of law over on the, what is a voluntary waiver of the privilege.
Right, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about crime fraud.
All right.
Area. Now, what is your specific complaint about what the Court of Appeals did in the crime fraud?
Well, they made an independent review of the facts. And not only were the documents, there was a long list of affidavits that we submitted in the trial court, which the Court of Appeals had. There were financial statements. There was a whole lot. I have a list in my notes here of extrinsic evidence that was before the trial court. The plaintiffs put forward some deposition testimony that they say was contradicted by one of the four documents. We deny that, but that was their contention. That's what made the fact issue. They put forth their petition. They put forth some corporate minutes about which there was no dispute. The corporate minutes were correct copies of the corporate minutes and described the transaction which occurred. And those were the facts. And if the Court of Appeals had been the trial court and made a factual determination based on that, yes, sir, I have to say that under the law, as I appreciate it, in the mandamus context, there would be no showing that they had abused their discretion.
That's
now,
my answer.
Basically,
what we're focusing on is not the substance of the various rulings, but procedurally, the Court of Appeals invading the trial judge's fact-finding process.
Yes, sir. That's what we say they did. Apparently, I've run out of time on the first go-round, unless there's any more questions before
me. I have one, please. Can you, back on the inadvertent deduction, under our rules, if you intend to assert a claim of privilege, if you do not do so in a timely manner, you will be deemed to have waived it due to inadvertence. Can you reconcile the waiver of the privilege due to inadvertence under that procedure with your proposed rule that the requiring a voluntary relinquishment of a known right to a privilege?
Well, the only way I can reconcile it is that in the former situation, you're operating under a specific rule that says you've got 30 days to make your objection, and Brooks no exception for that. And here we're talking about the waiver, voluntary waiver of the privilege. And the rule, I suppose, the answer, my best answer to it, sir, is that the rule says 30 days. It doesn't say 30 days unless you slept late or you were inadvertent. But that's what we're not talking about. A codified rule with square corners on it. When you look at this rule of evidence, it's the waiver of the privilege. It's voluntary waiver. And we believe that true inadvertence, coupled with some level of care that's above neglect, is the antithesis of voluntary. That's our position.
Any other questions? Thank you, John.
But the rule doesn't mention inadvertence as an exception.
The rule of evidence about waiver of privilege? Waiver of the privilege? No, sir. It just says that to waive it, you have to voluntarily waive it. And we say the word voluntary is a pretty important word. And there's my time's up. I'd be answering your question.
Any questions? Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May I please report, Ms. Lynn Liberato present argument for respondents.
May it please the court, your honors, my name is Lynn Liberato, and together with Larry Thompson, I represent Dr. Gary Freeman and other real parties in interest in this mandamus proceeding. At the heart of this case are four documents that are literally smoking guns that prove our case. And I feel like I need to go back and put this in a context, a factual context of what happened. There's no dispute about this. What happened is that Granada gave us, in response to a request for production, a room full of documents, fully 150,000 pages of documents they dumped on us. We then went through those documents that they're urging, and this is in the record, a letter that says basically get on with it, go look at those documents. And in those documents we found not just these four smoking guns, it wasn't four documents, it was 21. But there were four of them that they feel strongly enough that hurt their case, that go so much to the heart of the case that they have really raised the dispute, and quite frankly, it comes down to these four documents.
You say there are 21 documents that were a waiver of the attorney-client privilege?
Right, that were inadvertently produced. 21 that they later claimed, subject to the attorney-client privilege, now the dispute is not over those additional 17 documents, but they have really zeroed in on these four documents. But it's important, I think, from the standpoint of the issue of care taken, that it wasn't just four out of all these documents, it was 21. And maybe relatively speaking, you can argue proportions all day and all night, but it is involved more than four in terms of what happened. Now, the other thing that's important to note, I think, is that not only did they have the opportunity to look at these documents before they put them in the room, but we picked out the ones we wanted, and we set them aside, and we didn't take them out and copy them. We gave them to them. We bait-stamped them. We gave them to them, and they took them out, had them copied, and gave them back to us. And so that's what happened here. And that's really the issue in this case, is whether even if a document production like this is voluntary, even if, though it was inadvertent, that the delivery was voluntary, is that sufficient to waive the privilege? And the Court of Appeals said the answer to that question is yes, you do waive the privilege under those circumstances. But it wasn't operating in a vacuum. The Court of Appeals had the law to look at to make that determination, and that law is our rules of evidence, Rule 511 and 512. And what 511 says is that if a party voluntarily delivers documents, that the privilege is going to be waived. And then coming behind that, and probably even more significant, is Rule 512. 512 says the rule's not absolute. We're not going to be that harsh. There are instances when the voluntary delivery is not going to constitute a waiver. And it sets out two times. One is if the production was erroneously compelled, and a second if there was no opportunity to claim the privilege. There is no third exception under our rules for inadvertence. There's no dispute that neither of the other two apply.
But we still have to construe the word voluntary.
That is true, Your Honor. But in construing that, it is fair to look at the rules and look at what Rule 512 says. Here are the exceptions and what is meant by voluntary. And
so
frankly,
your view, though, is that there should be no exception for inadvertence under any circumstance, not just these, but any circumstance.
Well, under the two circumstances that are set out in the rules would be the only two exceptions. That's what the Court of Appeals tells.
And nothing else for inadvertence.
If a party voluntarily delivers but inadvertently produces documents, then there should be no exceptions.
So when the legal secretary sends over 10 documents and sticks in one that's not supposed to be in there, that's just too bad.
Well, unfortunately, I agree. And I'm not, when I say unfortunately, I know that kind of thing happens.
Is that a good rule?
I think it is a good rule.
And why do lawyers agree to the contract?
Well, I think if lawyers agree ahead of time, that's a different situation.
Why do they do it if the other rule is good?
I'm sorry?
Why do they feel the need to agree ahead of time for another rule if that rule is a good one?
Well, there could be instances where there's a need to hurry up the document production where somebody, and that's not what happened here, but there may be instances where there is a need for speed.
Isn't it commonplace for lawyers to agree that if there is inadvertent production, that will not constitute waiver?
I don't know if it's commonplace. I really don't know the answer. I haven't seen it that much, but I really can't honestly answer your question. But I do know this, that the purpose of the rule is to protect the confidentiality of the attorney-client relationship and the confidentiality of those documents. And once those documents get out into the public, get out and are produced to the other side, that the purpose of the privilege no longer exists.
Well, that would be true even if the disclosure was erroneously compelled, or if the document was produced without the opportunity to claim the privilege. Surely that's not the rule, that once it's out there, it's lost forever. The judge can't do anything about it.
No, that is absolutely true, and I think that's a policy consideration, that there are times that the rule shouldn't be so harsh. But there are all sorts of rules that we have to deal with, that we lawyers have to deal with, that y'all impose on us, that are harsh.
What problems do you see with the bids proposed by counsel?
Well, there's the problem of dumping that Judge Phillips and Judge Doggett point out. There's the problem of reverse discovery. Whose burden should it be to protect the privilege? Should it be the receiving party's burden to protect the privilege? I think the answer is no. Should it be the producing party's responsibility to protect the privilege? And the answer is yes. So how is it going to work mechanically if his theory is put into place where there may be some burden on the receiving party? Are we charged with looking at these documents and saying, uh-oh, this one hurts you and hurts you a lot, and it's one of your lawyer letters? You better take it back.
How does it work when you agree to it?
Well, that would be a different situation.
Well, but how does it work?
And I think that whenever you agree that you're agreeing to accept that burden. And I also think that something that is different in an agreement situation from what we have here is there was no list ahead of time. We were not provided with a list of the documents for which the privilege was claimed on until after the document production. And that's one of the problems here as to why this happened. I think, too, as a policy matter, the difference in a whole bunch of documents being produced like they are here is that the party claiming the privilege, that party has the most resources to protect the privilege.
In reality, isn't most document production done by paralegals?
Probably so in a lot of cases. But that's okay, because there are only certain areas you have to be careful about. In other words, it's not unreasonable, I would think, to have a paralegal look through the accounting department's letters and look through the accounting department's files. But when you get to the legal department's files and when you get to the executive files, that's when you need to be more careful. As one person put it to me, said, if you're in the parking lot, you don't look for snakes. If you're in the forest, you do. And so the snakes in this case are going to be found in certain places. And that's where you have that heightened care. And perhaps in those situations, I would hope that a careful lawyer would look at the place that he or she is the most likely to find those things that are going to be protected by the privilege.
Your opposing counsel cites a number of federal and other state opinions, and you rely primarily on Gulf and Texas authority. If we were to adopt your rule, would this put us squarely in the minority?
I don't think squarely.
Nationwide?
I don't think it would put us in the minority. I think in some places it's comparing apples and oranges. There are law review articles that say, as you indicate, that the majority opinion is not with the position that we're taking. But I think it's important to note that those other cases, particularly all the federal cases, do not have our equivalent of Rule 11, 511, and 512. And so they are operating, I won't say in a vacuum, but they develop their rules through the common law. That is the way that the procedures are left to the federal courts. Whereas in our state courts, we have those specific rules to follow, and that's 511 and 512. I think that also in Texas, we have a policy of open discovery, perhaps more so than other states. And so we do things a little bit differently than other states do.
So, Ronald, let me focus you back on the standard of review on mandamus. How do you respond to the argument here by Mr. Cook that what we have here is a classic case where the Court of Appeals substituted its judgment for that of two tri-courts that came to the same conclusion with regards to the argument you're now making that did not persuade those district judges?
Right. Well, in that, it's a question of abuse of discretion. Did the trial court abuse its discretion? But quite frankly, on the four documents, I think it's a question of law and an interpretation of the law. It's not a substitution of discretion, because my view would be that it's not a matter of discretion. It's a matter of law.
It's a matter of law. There is no exception for inadvertence.
Well, not in this case. Not under the circumstances in this case, there's not an exception for inadvertence.
How would you write an opinion that says that?
You would write an opinion
just
that says...
Just for this case?
No, of course not. Of course not. But that if a party voluntarily delivers documents, even though it's inadvertent, unless it comes under the exception set out in 512, that the privilege is waived.
Let me take you to an area where there is a discretion problem, and that's the crime fraud exception. What justification assuming we get past the first term, I'm putting on the second hand, what justification does the Court of Appeals have for going back and reversing
Well, I don't think they're factual determinations, but what the Court of Appeals did is it conducted its own in-camera investigation of those documents and determined that many of those documents came under the crime fraud exception. Certainly, it is not unusual for a Court of Appeals, having been worked at a Court of Appeals for a long time, I know, for the Court of Appeals to take in-camera the review of documents determined if they're to see if the trial court abused its discretion in determining whether there was a privilege. And so it would not be unreasonable or unusual to carry that forward and say that it would be proper for the Court of Appeals to look at those documents also to see if the exception applies. Now, we haven't seen those documents, obviously. We can't, and I couldn't in any good faith stand up here and tell you what specifically is in those documents. But I think I can say that just like the Court of Appeals has the authority to look at cases and determine whether a document is covered by the attorney-client privilege, it also can do that as far as the exception. But I think, too, to go back to Judge Gonzalez's question, and I'm sure that this grows out of Walker versus Packer, too, and just the whole idea of did the Court of Appeals act properly, I think that this case is really what y'all, I don't, obviously not specifically had in mind, but that goes to one of the key exceptions in Walker versus Packer when mandamus are lost. And that is when a case goes to, or when the documents go to, the heart of the case. And in Walker versus Packer, as the court recalls, that involved impeachment. The use of the documents was for impeachment. But in this case, these documents prove our case. They prove our case. We had these documents for almost a year. They had the opportunity in that time to claim that privilege. They had base-stamped copies of the originals. They knew what we had. And not until we were at a deposition and used those documents to question the party that was being deposed did they then later come back in and claim the privilege.
So you contend that even under their rule that they advocate, you would still be entitled to the document.
Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
Even if there are five standards and inadvertence is an excuse, you still would get to keep the document.
Under either standard. Under either standard. And it relates to what really are the factors that are most often cited by these other courts. There are five, but they really come down to two. The first one being the reasonableness of the care, and I won't reiterate that, but under the circumstances, I do not think that that was reasonable care taken to protect the privilege. And the second is fairness. And that's what I'm talking about right now in terms of fairness. We have used these documents for now for 3 years, but up until that time, for almost a year, they're in our, not just in our psyche, they're in our discovery plan, they change the pleadings, they change the questions on deposition, and Judge Harrison's order prohibits us from coming back and using those documents to even ask questions of witnesses. And so without our ability to do that, it is going to chill our ability to ask questions and really subject us to objections, valid objections, that whatever question we got about our case, when we're asking the person being deposed, that came from those documents.
Mr. Verano, I thought you stated that you have 17 other documents that are just as good, perhaps.
I don't think they're as good, Judge.
If
I misstated
good,
if I said that.
Good.
No, I don't even think I said that, but if I did, I apologize. What I said was that there were 17 other documents that they turned over that they claimed were covered by the attorney-client privilege, and they basically, I don't want to speak for them, but those documents just aren't at issue right now. And so my only point there was it wasn't just four, it was 17, but again, it's probably
unless
unfair.
Unless there later be any confusion about that, do we have all 17 of those documents?
I don't think so, but frankly, I'm not sure because I think it really goes back to your question before. Maybe if I could clarify just a little bit about what you have and what I think the Court of Appeals has done. The Court of Appeals first said you get the four memos. And you get the four memos on two bases. You get all four of them. One is because of the inadvertent production. The second is because they're all covered by the crime fraud exception. The Court of Appeals then said you get two of those four memos for an additional reason, and that is because there wasn't a timely response to the original request for production. You recall there was one request in which I think Judge Doggett, you did have the numbers right, that they produced 104 documents. Then a year later, after we got their memos and they knew they were in trouble, they came forward with an additional 115. So I don't want to get too far sidetracked, but two of those documents were not in the 104, but they were in the 115. Now,
two
in addition,
of the four documents.
Pardon me?
Two of these four.
Two of the four, right. What we call one and two, they were the Watson memos, for another way of putting it. So that is an additional basis for those two. The next issue is crime fraud. How many documents did they turn over on crime fraud? The Court of Appeals did an in-camera inspection and determined that 62 of the documents were covered by the crime fraud exception. That 62 included the four memoranda. Okay. So then what that left is, and this is the question mark, and I think what's causing the confusion, is there were those 115 documents, and they said all of those 115 were not timely, and therefore you get all those 115. But some of those 115 overlap with 104, and so that's why it's hard to know the exact numbers that come in there. But that's how the numbers break out, and that is what the Court of Appeals told me.
For you to prevail in this case, is it necessary for this court to write on both inadvertence and crime fraud, or could we write on one or the other?
Well, if you wrote on crime fraud, we win everything, because all four of the memos are covered by crime fraud if you agree with us and agree with the Court of Appeals. If, on the other hand, you just write on the four memoranda and the inadvertence issue, then we don't get the or there's no determination of the court's decision about really two other issues, both the crime fraud issue and the late production issue. So
that will affect another how many documents that I guess you've never seen.
Right, which I'm sorry, which?
A failure to write on mm-hmm. crime fraud would do what?
A failure of to write on crime fraud, that would give us the four memoranda, assuming that you agree with us on the inadvertent production issue. It would also give us the 114 documents that don't overlap with the earlier production. I can't tell you the exact number because we don't know the exact number because we don't know which overlap, but nonetheless.
What would a failure to write on crime fraud deny you?
To write on crime fraud would deny us those block of cases that aren't the four documents and aren't the late production. Everything else that the Court of Appeals determined was covered by crime fraud.
Some body of documents that you've never seen?
Right, we've never seen.
Okay.
We've seen the four, of course. And the four are what we use to make our prima facie case of crime fraud to trigger the court's in-camera inspection. But I think I feel fairly certain that that's correct in working through the numbers. The other issue, and we touched on it, of course, is the crime fraud issue and the holding of the Court of Appeals that said that we made a prima facie case that triggered them looking at the documents and then in turn giving us those crime fraud documents.
Is it necessary for us to look at those documents then in order to make a similar determination? Evaluate whether they're right or wrong.
I hate to ask you to do that, but probably so. Because you can't determine without looking at those documents whether they come within the crime fraud exception. And so I think the answer is yes. The other point that was brought out in the Court of Appeals opinion was, of course, this idea of the late production. And if I may just remind the court, what happened there is that, as we were talking about the numbers, is that the court said that they were not entitled to claim privilege on any of the documents that were produced almost a year later. And the final thing, there is an additional reason. I hate to muddy up the waters too much with this, but there is another reason that we briefed that the Court of Appeals did not address, that we are entitled to one of the memos, that's the Eller memo, in which we questioned one of their witnesses for 11 minutes before there was any objection raised. So to further muddy the waters, at least in terms of figuring out these numbers, is an additional reason.
Are you? Would you claim that the failure to assert the 17, the objection to the 17 is a waiver?
I don't think there's... do you mean, I'm sorry, but...
The 17 other attorney-client privilege documents that were produced that apparently are not being presented here. Does that waive any objections as to the other four under the prevailing case as well?
I've never thought of that. I don't think so. I think that just like in any kind of a document production, for example, in this one, originally they claimed privilege for 600 documents, and we were able to whittle it down by agreement of the parties to the 104. And so it seems to me that just like you could agree to the 104, you could agree that the 107, that you're not going to pursue the 17. I'm not entirely clear exactly at what point the 17 were given up, but they were certainly originally part of those that they claimed were covered by the attorney-client privilege. Let me finish just by saying that there are important policy considerations here, and that dumping is certainly one of them. That's what happened here. And that to adopt any less of a strict standard than the one that we're proposing is going to encourage that sort of thing. The other thing is that this court has recently held and continues to hold that inadvertence of counsel will not be good cause for a late response to a discovery request. We all make mistakes, but somebody has to pay the price for those mistakes. And in this case, it should not be us. There is no returning this case to the status quo. Either they're going to be hurt or we're going to be hurt. Because without these documents, it is going to severely inhibit our ability to bring our case before the trial court. It is going to, as I said before, to subject us to objections that any question we ask or evidence that we're seeking to elicit comes from our knowledge of these documents. And so there's no moving back to the status quo. And so for these reasons, we ask the court to deny the petition for writ of mandamus and to leave intact the holdings of the Court of Appeals.
Any other questions? Thank you, Kelly.
Very quickly, if I may. First, this matter of some suggestion that the Court of Appeals held that we were late in making our objection or our request for protection is wrong. The Court of Appeals, so we know what we're arguing about, what we're not arguing about. The Court of Appeals at page 7, I believe, of its opinion stated that recognized that they were making that claim that with respect to all documents that we tendered for in-camera inspection to the trial court, that we had made a timely, raised the objection timely. We are not arguing about any documents that had not, that were not tendered for in-camera inspection to the court. Now, with respect to this matter of the 21 documents, 17 and 4, that's a red herring. And at page 9 of our original brief before this court, there's a footnote that explains that we had withdrawn our objection to that early on, back in our meetings in the fall of 88, before this issue arose.
Are those documents, those 17, part of the record here?
I don't think they are, Your Honor, because we gave them to them. We backed off of that 4 years ago now, almost. About 4 years ago, as a matter of fact. Now, this matter of dumping, it's been the questions and the response have been from the standpoint of the provider of the document dumping a big number. In this case, the request of Granada, before we even get to Fulbright-Jaworski says, let's see the whole file. Request of Granada was for 69 different categories of documents, which when you read that 69 categories, you draw a line and it totally is every piece of paper that you have relative to your relationship with this company, which at that time had covered a period of 84 to 88. So, and that generated a lot of paper. So it wasn't that we were in a position to decide how many documents we're going to give them. We had to respond to their request. Now, Judge Phillips raised the question, the determination of prima facie crime fraud, isn't that a fact question? And my adversary, my worthy adversary said no. I want to say that bear in mind, I like to go back to basics when I can. The gravamen of a cause of action for fraud is intent of the defendant. Did he intend not to perform a future promise, or did he intend that the other fellow would relax? Usually, in the commercial transaction context, the facts of the transaction, what it was, are undisputed. I sold him my company. He paid me $1 million. But to get to the home plate on a cause of action for fraud, a fact finder is going to have to find that the defendant intended to do those things that make up the laundry list to get to fraud.
Here, do they not allege that you were engaged in a public relations campaign with shareholders, but you all were intending to strip the assets of the corporation?
Yes, sir. They allege
to strip of the assets.
They allege that in the original stock purchase agreement, where my client committed to provide up to $5 million for research and development, that we didn't do it, and we didn't intend to do it, and that's fraud. We say up to, as a matter of law, in such cases, means 0 to 5 million. We only gave about $1 million to. We loaned them another $3 or $4 million. My client lost about $4 million in the whole deal. But it's a fact question, a case of fraud. So therefore, doesn't it follow that to find a prima facie case of fraud requires an exercise in factual determination by the trial court? And that's what two trial judges did. And they want to get away from the question of how binding is that factual finding on the part of the trial court relative to did they make a crime fraud exception. And he also found that these documents don't have anything to do with any crime or fraud if there was any. And that's in the findings in the order.
Do we need to look at the documents in camera concerning the crime fraud exception?
Well, sir, I certainly have no objection to it. The problem is that the Court of Appeals, I guess you could, and you wind up with yet a different set of documents that would be discoverable. We'd have four decisions where they're saying the trial court could only make one. But I don't think so, Your Honor, because I think you have to give deference, as this court has said many times, to that fact-finding of the trial court. Just like I candidly admitted a while ago that had the Court of Appeals been the trial court, I couldn't say anything about their fact-finding in a mandamus context.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument on the second clause. The court will now take another brief recess.